Well, summer has arrived, which means our insect world is in full gear, so we thought it a good time for another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. This program is made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden, glad to have you back with us again.
It's my pleasure to be back, Bill.
All right. So, again, we're going to give the numbers out. We're taking your calls tonight, 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world? And we're going to start out tonight with some images that I found on a friend of mine posted on Facebook, and I contacted her. She wasn't quite sure what they were. And the first one she thought might be a leaf hopper, but it looks a little big for that. I'm not really sure. So we're going to turn that over to our expert right now.
Well, I understand that this friend is from Florida, and in Florida they may be called leaf hoppers, but nationally they're better known as katydids. And they are the cousins to the grasshoppers and to the crickets. And one of the major differences between grasshoppers and crickets, they all have those large hind legs that they use for jumping. But katydids have very long antenna, where grasshoppers have very, very short antenna. Grasshoppers tend to lay their wings flatter along their back, where katydids' wings are almost like a big balloon in a roof-like fashion over their back. And katydids tend to have a very pointed head. And then you have the crickets that have very, very round heads. There's some other differences in the groups, too, depending on where their hearing membrane is located in their body. But they all herbivores. They all feed on plants. But katydids normally not to the extent that that the grasshoppers can cause agricultural damage. And one of the reasons that they're called katydids is because they make a very unique sound, some of them do, and it almost sounds like katydid, katydid, katydid. And so, but the grasshoppers make noise too, but in a completely different way, as do the crickets.
Okay. So katydids, they don't swarm like grasshoppers do particularly?
No, not at all. In fact, grasshopper swarms still occur, but not to the magnitude that they did back in the 30s and the 1800s, where they would basically block out the sun. And that's because those are migratory grasshoppers, which we really don't have that much of occurrence in North America anymore. They still have it in Africa and in China. And in fact, that's what we call locust. Locusts are migratory grasshoppers, but down here they tend to call cicadas locusts instead of cicadas.
What has stopped, you know, I mean, you hear that all through history, you know, the locust came and destroyed the crops. What has abated that in our environment?
I think it's been basically just a change of urbanization has depleted that. And I'd have to say probably the fact that just so much of the land has diversified, and there's plenty of stuff for them to eat. And normally they will go on migratories when there's not that much stuff to eat, because they'll be forced to grow bigger flight muscles and go somewhere else. And their grocery store is always open for them.
Okay, so basically the droughts and the Dust Bowl of the 1930s is probably what caused them to pick up and migrate in mass like that. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. We're going to go to Margo from Shreveport first. Margo, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Hi. Thank you, Dr.
Bird.
You actually identified a colony of book lice on a swing set of ours like last year.
Yeah, that was very interesting. That was a wooden set, wasn't it?
It was.
You know, and they're called bark lice, but they really don't eat the bark. But it was quite interesting. What's bugging you today, Margo?
So we had a family member who recently returned from a camping trip, and as she they have a camper, and as she was cleaning it up, washing bed sheets, a light brown spider fell on her arm. She brushed it off, and our nature to be very inquisitive, so she caught it, put it in a jar, posted pictures to Facebook, and many of her friends quickly discerned a violin-shaped or fiddle-shaped marking on the back of the spider, and you know, said, "Kill it, kill it! It's a brown recluse." And then, you know, and then of course, our family, we started to Google it, and I said, "Well, does it have 8 eyes or 6 eyes?" And I don't know if she ever got that close to it, but I just wonder, in the case of when this happens, if it was truly a brown recluse, what do we do now? Do we search the camper for these? For an infestation? Do we think it was a stowaway?
I think it was a stowaway. They are called reclusive because they do not like to be in the limelight at all. And they do like to hide in bedding and clothing and such. The first time I was ever bit by a brown recluse, I had laid a towel down to lay down and work on something, and I got bit in the upper shoulder. But unless a wound ever occurs, then I would just, you know, not be too concerned about it. And, you know, campers are normally just used periodically.
Right.
And just to be aware, you know, before you climb into bed, just kind of look around. I do that routinely because I catch a lot of brown recluses at my house. In fact, everyone at LSUS came out of my house or my garage. But because I'm aware of them and I know what to look for. And so, but it is very important to be aware of your environment. And the brown recluse and the black widow are only the two venomous spiders that can cause any medical condition in the area. There are some spiders that can inject venom, but it's no more than like a bite of a sting of a wasp. And
okay.
So it's good that she became aware, and I'm glad she collected it. That's always a good thing to do. And I'm glad the people on Facebook were able to identify it for her. But as you know, when in doubt, you email it to Dr. Burden, right?
That's right. I need to give her your address.
Okay. Nice talking to you again. Thank you.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And you can give us a call right now. We have lines open, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world is fair game. And we're going to go next to Thomas from Westview, Texas. Thomas, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Well, hello there. How y'all doing today?
Hello. We're doing fine. What's bugging you, Thomas?
Hey, infestation of small caterpillars.
Okay. Are they smooth or hairy? Do they have spikes on them?
No, not really.
Okay.
No.
Well, that's the first question I ask anybody when it comes to caterpillars, because if a caterpillar has hairs or spikes on it, you definitely do not want to touch it, because many of them are designed to break off and inject a toxin into the tissue. But probably this time of year, you're probably looking at tent caterpillars. They will aggregate at the base of a tree. Tell me a little bit more about where you're seeing these at.
Inside our home, about an inch long.
About an inch long.
We find some dead ones all curled up, and then we'll find several inch long live crawling across the carpet.
Are you sure they're caterpillars, or could they be millipedes? Because millipedes, when they die, they will curl up. Caterpillars normally will not curl up when they die. And millipedes at this time of the year, for some reason, for some years, we'll just have an explosion of them, and they're absolutely harmless, and except the fact that they're a nuisance factor. But don't be picking these up either, because millipedes, they don't have fangs like centipedes do, and they don't have toxins to inject into your tissue. But what they do have is they can excrete through their joints. It's called reflex bleeding, a very terrible, odorous chemical that is very hard to wash off. It basically has to wear off. So I would just get the vacuum cleaner. Now, one way that you can tell whether they're millipedes or caterpillars, of course, by looking at the legs. Caterpillars don't have true legs the way millipedes do. But caterpillars are always soft-bodied, where millipedes have a little hard exoskeleton on them. So tap them with a pencil or something. And if they're hard, they're millipedes. And even if they are caterpillars, what's normally happening with caterpillars is that whenever they get ready to pupate, and flies do the same thing, they will crawl away from wherever they're eating, and then they'll pupate a distance after that, or just at the base of the tree. Sometimes they're just lost. If things get in your house, most of the time they are just lost, or they're searching for some type of a moisture or food source. So do you think these are caterpillars or millipedes, Thomas?
I think they're going to be millipedes now.
Okay. But like I said, just sweep them up, vacuum them up, and you might want to check your weather stripping around your doors to see if that's going to be an issue for you this winter. Because if you can see any bit of light at all, insects and millipedes. And millipedes aren't classified as insects. One of the reasons is because they don't have antennae and they have many more than six legs. But they don't have a million legs like the myth says. Mm-hmm. They just have two pairs of legs per segment. Okay. Thanks for your call.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist tonight, Dr. Beverly Burton. We have phone lines open right now, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, are welcome, and Dr. Burton will help you identify or eradicate or draw to your garden if you need some helpful insects. We're going to go next to John from Bossier City. John, you're online with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
Well, I have sort of an odd question. I wonder if Dr. Burton could direct me to someone that may know it or tell me the answer herself. But I warn you, it's a little strange.
All right.
So I'm interested in pure survival skills, not really bushcraft. And so entomophagy comes into that occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I piddle in it, but I'm not extremely experienced. But one highly available food source that's already been mentioned today is the tent caterpillar. And I wonder if you know anything about the possible edibility of it. I haven't seen anything on any internet resources nor books. I wondered if you could make any conjectures about whether or not it may be edible.
Yeah, well, most of the time when we're talking about the word entomophagy, that just means the eating of insects. And what's interesting about this, John, it is only North America and basically Europe that has an aversion to the thought of eating insects. Everywhere else in the world, they are indeed eaten as a part of their daily diet or their seasonal diet.
Yes,
and most of the time, one of the things that are most commonly eaten are grubs. These are the big, juicy immatures of beetles, normally June bugs, the white C-shaped grubs that you dig up out of your yard. Those will eventually turn into June bugs or May bugs that we call them around here. Also, the immatures of wasps. People will collect the paper shell and they will dig them out. Salt. I've had these. You saute them in a little bit of olive oil, sprinkle a little seasoning salt over them, and they actually taste like popcorn. And they're actually very good. And then there's things like in the Orient, they'll eat a lot of large adult aquatic insects as well because it's so aquatic in that part of the country. But as far as tick caterpillars go, as caterpillars go in general, they would probably have the same nutritional value as grubs. But if I were going to eat them, what I would take and do, and you know how you can blanch a pepper and rub all the skin off? I would take and blanch them or just hold them over a flame and to get all those hairs off of them, and then I would either saute them or maybe bake them in some way. But definitely get those spines and those hairs off of them first, just in case. And it's been proven that insects are actually very high in protein and very low in cholesterol. There was a paper written on this back in the early 1990s. And there used to be an insect as food newsletter that came out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison by Jean DeFoliart when I was up there. And it's becoming more and more of a trend. A lot of larger city restaurants are specializing and insects as part of their ingredients in their food. And if you go down to the Insectorium in New Orleans, they have a session on that as well. And so a lot of people just think of chocolate covered ants. Well, you're just eating chocolate because there's not much protein there. It's a little bit of chocolate and crunch and the novelty of it. But the true nutritional aspect of insects has yet to be fully developed in this country. So I'm all with you there, John.
All righty. Do you think there's any danger of parasites, as you see in some of the larger grasshoppers and things? Anything to be
concerned? Yeah. The thing about any parasites, with the parasites in the grasshoppers, you know, normally if you cook them well enough, it's going to kill them, just like if there's anything in beef or pork and things like that. The high heat's going to kill the parasite as well. And a lot of those parasites would not be able to exist in a mammal's body. They're designed specifically for invertebrates. And so where the idea of eating dead parasites may not be appealing, it's going to be a very rare case.
Thank you so much for your information.
Thanks for your question, John.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. We have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we're going to go back to another photograph that was sent to me again from Florida. And this was a very nice photograph of a very creepy spider in a web. And she wasn't quite sure what kind of spider that might be.
I emailed you this.
Yes.
It's called an Arigope spider, A-R-I-G-O-P-E. And these are some of the largest spiders that we have in North America, aside from the tarantula and some of the wolf spiders, the ground-dwelling spiders. But these are oftentimes just called garden spiders. They will take and build these elaborate webs overnight. And most of the time, they're brightly colored. One of the more common ones is called the garden spider. It is very brightly colored in a black and yellow colorations. And most of the time, in their webs, they'll have a very strong, thick, zigzag-like of a pattern to them. They're extremely beneficial to the ecosystem. They're feeding off of other flying insects and such. And so I just leave these alone because they'll take their web down early in the morning and then build it back up that night. Mm. But the problem most people have is they don't see it and they'll run into it and then they'll think, you know, flashbacks from B-grade movies from the 50s will come back and they'll think, you know, they'll have like arachnophobia and type of things. But they're just gorgeous and they have... There's several different groupings of these, and the one that's here that's on our webpage, it has its abdomen that's kind of attached high up on the thorax, and sometimes these have very hard shields on them as well, and so as do some crab spiders.
Now, how do those relate in size to like the banana spider, which I think is the orb spider?
These are orb spiders.
Okay, those are.
Yeah.
But they're not colorful like those big yellow banana, sprawling legs.
And some of them are a little bit drabber than not so brightly colored as the other ones are. But it also makes you wonder a lot of things in nature when they're brightly colored, especially yellow and black, they're sending a message that I may be, you know, something that you don't want to mess with.
Right.
And that's why you have the black and yellow yellow jackets and the black and the yellow on coral snakes. It's a very prominent color combination in nature as a warning sign. It's almost like wearing gang colors, I suppose.
Yeah, and I once found a coral snake in my pool back in Florida.
Oh, that's not good.
Well, it was in the skimmer, so I was able to get it out and use the net, you know, that you pick up the leaves, and it's sort of like a slingshot. I flung it back into the woods where it could go off and be a snake rather than killing it. So you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist. We have phone lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world is fair game, and we'll just keep on going tonight. We've got Ann from Gilmer, Texas. You're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight? Hello, Ann.
Hello, I'm on.
Yep.
Hey, hello.
You're on the air with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, speaking of the spiders, we used to catch grasshoppers and throw them in those spider webs so they'd watch them spinning up.
Mm-hmm.
And they could eat them later on.
That's right.
Yes. But anyway, I have these little clear ants, clear red ants. They're so busy. They're just running them back and forth over and over and over. And I'm wondering, and I put boric acid down, but they just run a trail through that. I don't know where they're coming from, where they're going. They're just so busy. I can't find the destination or their or where they're living.
Are they in your house, Ann?
No, they're outside.
Oh, then they're fine. Yeah, a lot of ants are very secretive as to where their opening of their nest are. And there are several different species of ants that would meet that criteria. You never see them carrying anything. They're just running back and forth all the time.
Yes, and they're just tiny.
Yeah. They may
they
be...
They don't sting. They don't hurt you. They don't do anything. They just run over you. If you're standing in the way, they're they just run right over your foot, and they're on the trail again.
Mm-hmm. Ants are fascinating creatures in that aspect. They lay down trails that... that are basically chemical trails. They're called trail pheromones, and that's what they're following. And I can guarantee you that even though you can't see where they start or you can't see where they stop or what they're going to and from, they are dealing with either a water source or maybe a dead June bug. I walked into my office today from the parking lot, and I saw three piles of soil. And if you uncovered the soil, then there were fire ants feeding on dead June bugs. Mm. And so there's going to be either a water or food source somewhere. And they're a very important part of the ecosystem if they're not causing you or your pets any damage. As to exactly what kind they are, I would have to see them, especially since they're so small. There is one of the smallest ants we have in this area, probably aren't yours because these are called literally the little black ant. But what you may be describing is something that they also call pharaoh ant, or when I was a kid, they call them sugar ants. And those were very lightly, kind of a light red blonde color. Does that sound like that may be what you're talking about, Ann?
Yes.
Okay. And they're just, you know, like I said, they're harmless. Just let them be part of the ecosystem. And so, very good question. Do you have anything else, Ann?
That's it, honey. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, you have a great day, and thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. All lines are open right now, and you feel free to give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly kind, is welcome tonight. And we're going to move on to another photograph that we have. This one I was lucky enough to take. This little guy was just sitting on a branch outside my patio, and I was out photo hunting that day, and I walked by and just happened to turn and see him there. So he nicely posed for about 7 snaps of my camera, and this one, he looks like he's smiling in it, so I think he just had his glamour shot taken. So
yeah, this particular dragonfly is in the group that's the most common group that we have here in the listening area for Red River Radio, and that is they're called the skimmers. The family name is Lilabelulidae, a mouthful, and one of the first things you look at is their wing venation, and they have so many veins in their wings, you wonder, how do you ever figure out what you're looking at? Well, it takes some time, it takes some training, and my eyes are trained, and one of the things that you can see very well in this picture is that in the front wing and in the hind wing, right at the base, are two areas that are shaped like triangles. And the triangles are shaped very differently from each other. So that takes it away from the darners, which is another large group in this area. And they're called darners, and the other family is called skippers because dragonflies lay their eggs in or on the top of water. And so when the female gets ready to lay their egg, she's normally accompanied by the male. We call this flying in tandem. And they will dip down and wash some eggs off, come back up and dip down, almost like the darning of a needle or just as a rock skipping across the water. Now, the third major group of dragonflies in the area are called clubtails because most of them will have an enlargement at the terminal part of their abdomen. This one has a, when I first thought that, oh, that may be a clubtail because there is a little bit of an enlargement at the end of the abdomen. But luckily, Bill's photograph skills are such that he was able to get some of the wing venation that I needed. Not the most definitive one, but I can see partial of it. And so I'm 99% sure that this is a skimmer. And dragonflies are an extremely very, very important part of the terrestrial ecosystem as well as the aquatic ecosystem because their immatures are aquatic. And their immatures are very fascinating by the way they feed. If you ever watched a praying mantid feed, well, they'll reach out with their front claws. We call them raptorial, and they'll grab their prey and pull it back in. Well, the immature of dragonflies and damselflies feed that way also, but instead of reaching out with their front legs, they reach out with a very specifically designed part of the mouth parts where it goes out, grabs it, and brings it back in. So it's almost like the upside down type of an action of a praying mantis. And so, very good photo. And the thing about it, dragonflies are not that hard to catch, even though they're very, very fast. If you ever watch them, they will fly in a certain pattern. Mm-hmm. And when I'm out hunting with my entomology students, they'll be running all around the field trying to catch dragonflies. And I will stand in one place, and I'll watch them, and then I'll move over. And the next time they come close to that one bush, boom, I nabbed it. And it looks like, Dr. Burton can catch dragonflies where we can't. And then I teach them, watch them. They'll fly in patterns.
I was camping once, and one landed on the cooler, and he allowed me to pet him. Just literally just stroke his back over and over and over again. It was the most mysterious thing that I'd ever seen.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever petted a dragonfly. You got me
cool.
On that one.
Yeah. He was just sitting there, and I just a real light touch, and he just would allow me to stroke his back. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to David from Nacogdoches. David, you're online with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi. Good evening, Dr. Burton.
Good evening.
I've got a problem with leafcutter ants, and they've been around for a couple of years now, but their area, their mounds are getting bigger and bigger, and I don't necessarily want them dead. I'd actually like for them to move over to my high school principal's yard, if that's possible, but I'd like to get rid of them, and I've tried pouring hot water on them. That didn't do anything. I can't find on anything on the internet for getting rid of them, but they completely deforested a little peach orchard that I've got, and those were fighting words. Now they've got to go.
Well, the problem with leafcutter ants is not only do they take all the vegetation off of the trees, but their nests, they can, like you said, they get bigger and bigger over time. And there have been, you know, parts of trucks that have actually fallen down into these agricultural equipment that they have to get a tow truck to pull out because they're deep and big. And that would be one of my major concerns, other than they're taking all the vegetation off the thing. I don't think you're going to be able to get them to move. I think you're going to have to go ahead and eradicate them. And
okay, let's do that.
Yeah, I would suggest two things. One is basically used for fire ants. It's called, the active ingredient is acephate, A-C-E-P-H-A-T-E. And there is a new fire ant chemical that's been produced by the BASF Corporation, and it's called Altrevin, Altrevin, and the active ingredient is a chemical that is not a pyrethrin, so I think it'll be effective in that. It's called a metafluorazone, and so Altrevin, acephate, metafluorazone, all three of those are potential ant things with you, and maybe even a generalized you know, insecticide. But one thing I wouldn't do, and I don't know why people do this here in the South, but they will pour gasoline down in there and set it afire, and that's very dangerous, and it does more damage to the soil than it does anything. So don't pour kerosene or gasoline down the nest and set that afire. That's not good at all. So good luck
and
with
again,
that.
These guys have set up in a little fruit orchard. Are either of those chemicals that you mentioned, the acetate or the altrevin, are they potentially harmful to if I'm ever lucky enough to get a peach out of this deal, would it be harmful to that?
No, because these are not systemic pesticides. They're not going to be taken up through the roots of the plants there at all.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I find out anything else, I'll get Bill to post it online. But
okay.
I would not want them close to my house. It's not good. But they're absolutely fascinating native ants, and the fact that they take this vegetation, and they basically don't eat the vegetation, but they eat the fungus that grows on the vegetation. And
yeah, there's a display of them at the kids' museum there in Shreveport.
Yeah, I don't know if that's still active since Shreveport's been closed for about 6 months or so, probably close to a year now. But I saw a news article where there's a private foundation that's going to try to get that opened up again, and I hope they can restart that leafcutter ant colony, because from an ecological point of view, from a natural point of view, they're absolutely fascinating little critters. And you know, there's over 1,000 species of ants in this world, and they're just, because they're so resilient, it's very hard to, you know, knock them down. And so thanks a lot for your call.
I'm in my yard. I just want to get rid of this one species.
I understand.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and our lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, is welcome. We're going to go next to Robert from Natchez, Mississippi. Robert, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Good evening. Thank you. Dr. Burden, I need to ask about cockroaches.
Okay.
The cockroaches that some people call them wood roaches, some people even call them water bugs, you know, the big cockroaches.
Yeah.
Okay. When I lived in Austin, this was 30, 40 years ago now, I heard on the radio something I had never heard before and have never heard since, that though you cannot, there's no poison that will eradicate these bugs because they live out in the wet woods, which we have lots of, but that you could make a trap out of a large glass jar by putting Vaseline on the inside of the bell and putting a potato in it. Now, not only do I know this works, it works great. The first time I heard about it and tried it, I lived in a place that was totally infested, and I fixed a trap and set it outside when I went out for the night. When I got back early in the morning, I thought about it stumbling through the door, picked it up, held it up to the light, and it was teeming with roaches, and I immediately dropped it, and it was horrible. But I reset it, and though you cannot eradicate them, you can so reduce a population that you rarely ever see them. Now, I keep one under the sink, a trap under the sink. I keep one outside in the carport where they seem to come from, and I almost never see them in the house. Have you ever heard of this?
I've heard of similar things. You can use different types of bait as well. There's nothing special about a potato, but you want something that has a lot of moisture to it and something that they can have some type of nutritional value that they can chew with their mouth parts. So a potato would probably be one of the best things. I'd be curious to find out which is better, a sweet potato or what we call a white potato or an Idaho potato. But that Vaseline, they can get in, but they can't get out, because
correct,
that will mess up their pads on their feet. And so...
Now, Doctor, one other thing. I have found if you never move it and never clean it out, these creatures will eat each other.
Oh, yeah.
I have a jar that's, you know, a quarter of the way full of desiccated roach parts.
Yeah. They're omnivorous. They'll eat anything that has any kind of nutritional value. They are carnivorous. And, well, what's the other word? Cannibalistic is the word I was looking for. They're carnivorous and they're cannibalistic, but they're really omnivores. They'll eat anything they can get any nutritional value out of. Now, let's just talk about roaches in general. Just for the general audience out there, what you're describing are the large And they may, they go by different names. You need to, between the two of them, you need to take a look. And cockroaches, when you look at them from above, you cannot see their head. You can see their antenna, but you cannot see their head. It's almost like they have a hoodie on. And that circular piece that surrounds their head, if it's completely brown, then that is the wood cockroach. If it's brown with a white halo around it, that's the American cockroach. And that's the one that's really, really hard to keep out of people's living facilities. Those are the ones that they actually call the water bugs down in Florida and such. But the worst cockroaches of all are the little German cockroaches. I tell people that cockroaches come in three sizes, small, medium, and large. And the small ones are the little German cockroaches. They have bands on their hood, light and dark bands. The other one are the what we call the Oriental cockroach. And these names are unfortunate, but that's just what common that's developed over time. And they normally don't have well-developed wings. And if you do have cockroaches in your house, the guy was talking about using boric acid for the millipedes earlier. Boric acid does work on cockroaches because it's an area, it irritates their exoskeleton, and they will lick it off, and then it gets into their stomach, and it blows holes in their stomach. And so it's a stomach poison. But if you don't want to put the boric acid down, because it can be a hassle, if you just want to use these little cockroach traps, what a lot of people also revert to are glue boards. And that works as well, but you got to put down a lot of glue boards depending on the population of your cockroaches.
Well, listen, one place I lived in Austin was right on a bayou. Like a Mississippi bayou, not a Louisiana bayou. And I got gallon jars and fixed them, and I kept finding one turned over with, of course, no roaches in it. And then one evening I looked out and saw a raccoon between its legs and was eating it just like popcorn, was eating the roaches out of it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. Raccoons, and if it's not a raccoon, it could be a possum, or it could be an armadillo that can knock things over in urban areas like that because they just root around. And good for the raccoon. We were talking about eating insects earlier today, although a lot of people would not want to hear about eating cockroaches. But thanks for your call, Robert. Very, very interesting. Yep.
Thank you, Doctor.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Dan, who is on the road. Dan, you're online with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you? Hello, Dan? Okay, who is on this line? All right, well, we're going to go on to our next call then, and we're going to go now to somebody. We don't know who this name is. They didn't get it to me, but they're online right now. You're online with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
Hi, this is Jim DeFore.
Okay.
And this is a perfect time to talk to you because I'm calling right after the person who called about the cockroaches.
Okay.
So we had an issue with some cockroaches in the house in Baton Rouge that my brother lived in, but I took care of those with boric acid tablets.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have these really small little bugs. They're no big when they're full adult size. They're no bigger than like the nail of your small finger, but. They just seem to be profusely coming out from everywhere. And so what's the best way to treat those types of bugs?
Can you tell me if they have wings?
No, they do not have wings.
Can you tell me the shape of them?
They're almost like the same size, same length to dimension as an ant, but...
What color are they?
Brown.
Brown. Okay. Do they have pincher-like forceps in the back?
Oh gosh, you're asking me to. I didn't get that close to. But I can say they range from extremely small up to, like I said, the adult size of and they love crevices to come out of.
Oh man. Yeah. I think what you're describing are something that's called earwigs, because earwigs are actually very closely related to cockroaches, but they have very short wings that you'll never see, and they love to crawl up into tight places. And They're absolutely harmless. They do have little pincher-like things on the back of their abdomen. And if they're as small as you're talking about, and some of them, they run the range between, I've seen them as small as just a few millimeters in length, maybe 32nds of an inch, or up to an inch in length. And they're completely harmless, except for the fact that they're a nuisance. They will sometimes rear their abdomen up and use those pinchers almost like a scorpion, but they can't even break the skin. They're actually pretty pathetic little things. But they can be a huge pest in nurseries that grow flowers because they do like to crawl up into tight places, and they'll crawl up into the developing bud of the flower and destroy the petals. And so my advice to you, boric acid is not going to work on these guys at all, even though they're very close related to cockroaches. But they don't carry the myths of that cockroaches spread filth and stuff. They're actually pretty clean little animals, insects. And so I've never heard of that many coming into a house, but, you know, you hear something new every day when you work in this field of entomology. And so I would just start backing them up and maybe see where they're coming in from and do it that way. But 90% sure you've got earwigs. Now, a lot of people think they'll crawl up into your ears and enter into the brain and eat themselves out the brain through the other side. That's not why they're called earwigs. They're called earwigs because their hind wings, which people hardly ever see, is shaped like a rounded ear. And so that's the story on earwigs. That's a great call. Thanks for calling, Jim. And where are you from?
Fort Worth, Texas.
Fort Worth. Thanks for your call, Jim.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. So if earwigs don't go into your ear, how about eye worms? Are those real?
Worms that get in your eyes?
No, you know, the little things when you close your eyes and...
Oh, the floaters?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're real, but... that's when you need to bring that up with Health Matters,
right?
You know, and talk about things with the eyes. That would actually probably be a pretty cool topic for Health Matters.
Exactly.
You know, abnormalities of the eye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You. Give us a call now, 800-552-8502. We have a caller online, William. You are online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
I was wondering. Why do dragonflies lay their eggs in water?
Well, because when the eggs hatch, the immatures actually live in water. And they're predators, and they'll feed on other aquatic insects. And sometimes they will even feed on very small fish and frogs. But then when they get ready to become adults, then they will crawl up on a piece of vegetation and emerge as an adult. So the adults live on land, and the immatures, the nymphs, live in water, and so that's why the eggs are laid in water, William. Did that answer your question?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, William. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We still have four lines open, so you can get in quick. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Now we actually have all lines open because Fred just dropped off from Kilgore. Fred, call back if you want to get in real quick. And in the meantime, we're going to talk about the different variety of ash borers and what has happened in that front on the emerald ash borer.
Yeah, the emerald ash borer continues to be moving west and south. It's pretty much confirmed that it's here in the Shreveport area, so it's probably over into Texas by now. And it's interesting. An article crossed my desk the other day. The four most common, well, not most common, but the four worst invasive pests. These are the non-native pests in the insect world. And one of them, I don't know if it's reached Louisiana yet or not, but it's called the Marimot steep bug. And it's very, very bad with fruit trees. And I'm going to be going through the collection this next month to see if we have any in the collection at this time. And, of course, spotted Drosophila flies are always an issue, the ones that I'll get on fruit. And then there's a new one that's coming in. It's called the spotted lantern fly. And it's basically moving south. And so I'm going to keep my eye on that one. And then there's one that's basically spread internationally. So it's what we call cosmopolitan. And that's the Capra beetle, the beetles that feed on wool and carpets and stuff like that. But as far as the emerald ash borer, it continues to be a pest. And there's a lot of great research that are still being done in that area.
And the fruit fly, that's the one you send to biology students to pull out the salivary gland and get their DNA smear. Is that not correct?
Absolutely, yep.
I remember trying to do that in college. That's why I'm not a brain surgeon today. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We have a line open right now, 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Chris from Kilgore. And Mary, please hang on the line. Don't hang up. We'll be coming to you in a moment. Chris from Kilgore, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Yeah, good evening. I've got a question. We've got some insects that only seem to come out of my door jamb where when it rains, and they really huddle around in large numbers, and they look like similar to what a flea looks like, but they literally number in the hundreds. But after the rain goes away, they disappear. I've looked online some things, and best I could tell, it was some kind of an insect that basically lives in damp wood, and really was nothing definitive about what it was. I just wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah. Do they form large circular little aggregations?
Yes, ma'am, they do.
Okay, I think I know exactly what you're describing. They are extremely small, and we don't really know why they will form these large aggregations, but it's normally always associated with a rain event, and they're called springtails. And they feed on mold spores, pollen. They have chewy mouth parts. They're very, very primitive insects. And they go by the scientific name of Calimbula. And the reason they're called springtails is they have a little structure underneath them that fits into a latch. And if they sense danger, it almost works like a catapult. They'll release it, and it will fling them up in the air away from the danger. They have no control over where they're going. They just know they're getting, you know, away from wherever they're feeling danger. They're absolutely harmless. And so that's what they are. They're springtails. Very interesting.
So sometimes, you know, when you open the door, we have small grandchildren that in this house, and of course they're crawling around and everything. And
you can just vacuum them up.
Just vacuum them up. So yep. Really no treatment for them or anything.
No, they're absolutely harmless. In fact, they're one of my favorite little groups. I happen to be a big fan of springtails. They're not dangerous. They're not venomous. They don't carry any diseases. They're just co-living with us. You know, people ask me all the time, when are the insects going to take over the world? And my answer is, darling, they already have.
we're guests in their homes.
Yes, that we are. Thank you for your call.
Okay. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
No problem, Chris.
All right, and we're going to go next. We've got a full bank of phone calls right now, so we're going to go next to Mary from Gladewater. Mary, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking my call, and hello, Dr. Burden.
Hello, Mary.
Hi, I have something that I've seen on my elm trees. I haven't seen it on any other tree, but it looks like a spider web, only it's thicker, kind of like a webworm web, and it's not on the small branches and leaves like a webworm web. It's on the trunk of the tree. You know, the bark will have crevices in between pieces, and it's really small. It may be like the size of my thumbnail, and I can't see I haven't been able to find any kind of insect there.
When you say it's small, but you haven't seen any type of insects there, what are you calling that's the size of your thumbnail, the web?
the web itself.
Yeah. I think I know exactly what you have, Mary. And if Glade Water was closer, I'd be at your house in 2 hours, because these things are called web spinners. And they live in galleries that made with the web. And they're basically hunters, and they're the only insects known to humans that can actually run backwards. Mm. And they're not readily encountered, but where they do exist, they normally exist in large numbers. And so we can't say that they're rare. We can only say that they're rarely encountered. And so they're not really harming your tree, Mary. And
okay.
And you would never see them hardly at all unless you really wanted to excavate them. And I had a student 2 years ago, Carlos, that collected some web spinners, but they were outside of the tree, outside of the bark, and that's the only reason he was able to capture those. And so very interesting little insects. And their web spinners are on their front legs. It's not like, you know, the tail end of caterpillars. Well, caterpillars produce silk from their mouths, but these guys produce the silk webbing off of these special glands in their front legs, web spinners.
Really?
Very fascinating little things. Great call. Thanks so much for calling, Mary.
Thank you.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We have Gary on hold right now. We'll get to you in just a moment, Gary. But first, we go to David from Minden. David, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Yes, good evening, Dr. Burden.
Good evening.
I have an issue with horseflies.
Oh, gosh.
I live in Minden, Louisiana. I live outside the city limits on a heavily wooded lot, about 3.5 acres. And as soon as I leave the house, whether it's morning, noon, or in the evening, they pounce on me, and they do it really quickly, and they really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it is. I can't tell their source, and I'm not sure if there's any relationship with wearing cologne or anything like that that maybe attracts them, but I was trying to get some advice on how to deal with them and maybe find the source of these horseflies and get rid of them.
Yeah. The thing about flies is they're always going to be in an area and where they have some access to moist, decaying organic material, because that's where they lay their eggs. And it's oftentimes the female that will take the blood meal. And horseflies feed completely different than mosquitoes. You know, their mouth parts are almost like a little sword that they pierce your skin with, and that's why it hurts so bad whenever you get, as they say, bitten by a horsefly. So you might look for a source of wet organic material as a place where you might find the adults as well. Now, as cologne is concerned, I don't know if they would be associated, attracted to any different types of cologne. If I was getting nailed that bad, I might want to start, you know, maybe wearing a little bit of repellent. And you don't have to go as far as well as using DEET. The CDC has now endorsed a 0.1% what's called lemon eucalyptus oil. And you might want to look into lemon eucalyptus oil. And what I would do, I would also find some way to attract them, kind of take them away from that area. But horseflies, stable flies, are very, very hard to control. You have my utmost sympathy with that, David. Mm.
Can I ask you this? Is there any relationship to horseflies and livestock? Because I had some neighbors years ago that had horses, and I recall when they had horses, the horse flies were really, really bad, but they moved, and of course they took the horses with them. So
they are very much associated with livestock, hence the name horsefly. But and if you think about it, livestock, you're going to have manure paddies, and that's a perfect place to lay your eggs and for the immatures to develop. And so absolutely they're associated with livestock, no doubt about it. Livestock is an easy host for them to feed off of.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for
that. Good luck with that. That's tough.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we're going to go next to Gary from Burke, Texas. Gary, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Thank you.
Hello, Gary. Gary, turn your radio down.
Hello.
Yeah, sorry, turn your radio down. And what's bugging you tonight?
Well, spiders. I don't worry with spiders, but, you know, I have these spiders that make these webs all around my house.
Are they are they there constantly all the way around your house?
Well, on the front and the side, yes, ma'am.
And they're there 24 hours a day?
Well, I mean, I ain't going to look for them, but the webs are.
Okay. Well, yeah. Then if the webs are there, then the spiders are there.
Yes, ma'am.
Like I said, they're a nuisance. What I would do if it was me, I would get a long enough handled broom where I could just sweep them out on a weekly basis, and that's going to deter them.
So that was my question. If I swept them off or if I pressure wash them, they won't come back, or they will come back.
If you're consistent, if you're persistent enough, they will go away. And the thing about it is that they're not brown recluses, because brown recluses don't have regular spider webs, and they're not black widows, because black widows don't have normal spider webs. Plus, you would never hardly ever catch a black widow under the eaves of a house. They like where things are low or in very tight crevices. Mm-hmm. And so right now they're a nuisance value to you, and they're probably doesn't make your house look very nice either. You're losing maybe a little bit of the curb appeal there if you have spider webs all over your house.
It looks good at Halloween.
Yeah, it looks good for Halloween. Well, leave them up for Halloween.
The monsters would like it.
Yeah.
Right on. But so they're not going to paint hurt.
No. No, they're harmless.
Well, one more question about spiders. I'm no technologist, but I've got a little garden, you know, not real big, just
sure.
But I see these little long-legged spiders.
Leave them in there.
Just don't worry with them.
No, they're beneficial. They're eating the pest. They're doing you a favor. They're saving you money from not having to buy pesticides.
Okay, well, cool. I ain't worried with them. I mean, they're still growing.
Yeah, just leave them in there. They're fine. Don't mess with them. They're not aggressive. Thanks for your call, Gary.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right. And with the exception of brown recluses and the black widow, most spiders are beneficial.
You know, my question is, what they do to you?
Right.
You know, if they're not bothering you, if they're not doing anything to you, leave them alone.
All right. We're going to try to get one more quick call in. Edward, we need your question very quickly because we're running out of time. What's bugging you tonight? Hello, Edward.
Thank you, Dr. Edward from Bossier City. I was listening earlier, and I was thinking silverfish, but it came up earwigs. Is the same eradication method for silverfish that are in and around your home that you would do for earwigs? I'm intrigued by the vacuuming technique.
Yeah, earwigs are, silverfish are harmless. And I was thinking silverfish, too, until he described the color. That's why I asked what color they were. I leave silverfish alone in my house. They're not doing anything. I kind of like them around. They entertain the dogs and the cats sometimes. But silverfish are feeding on dead starchy material. Especially when we used to have cardboard boxes that were glued together with animal glue, they would feed on that a lot, or with plant glue. And so, yeah, same thing. Vacuum them up. Just realize that they're a pest nuisance, not any harm whatsoever. And I'm being told that I got to say goodbye. Thanks for your call, Edward.
Thank you. Take care.
And why do we find silverfish in books all the time? Dead silverfish, of course.
Because they're eating the binding of the backbone of the book. And because a lot of times that's a starchy-like material in older books. Not to be confused with book lice. That's something completely different.
All right. Well, I don't like them eating my books either way, so.
Okay.
You've been listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. Beverly, thank you for joining us again.
My pleasure, Bill.
We'd like to thank each and every one of you for calling tonight and helping us out with this program. And our program is produced by Bill Beckett and Dr. Beverly Burden, with help from Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards and Tim Schnell tonight. And we will have the podcast of this up before about 10 o'clock tonight. tune in July for the next edition of What's Bugging You on July 17th. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria-Bineville, KBSA El Dorado-Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches.